Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair this afternoon, and welcome back our friend Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive Incorporated in Hoosick Falls. Gordon, as you know, has been in the game for a long time, starting back in factory mechanics training school in Wolfsburg, Germany, back in 1979 already. He looks pretty youthful still. Gordon Fricke, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org. Or you can comment on our website, wamc.org/voxpop. There's a spot to comment right there. In the meantime, we'll get to the phones in just a moment. So one of the topics that comes up again and again and again on this program is, how long can I go between oil changes? And you have been doing your homework.
Yeah. Oil is a big topic, justifiably so. In the early years of cars and internal combustion engines, the oil had to be changed very, very often.
Yeah.
The engines were loose, sloppy. A lot of pollutants, a lot of debris got into the oil. The oil quality wasn't as good, so you had to change it a lot, 1,000 miles sometimes. And then a standard of 3,000 miles became pretty common.
Yeah.
And that was a really good catch-all because the oil was getting dirty, getting full of contaminants. It was time to change it. Well, oil started getting better, and more additives got blended into the oil, making it more synthetic. And some of the engineers and scientists realized that the oil was capable of lasting much longer chemically, but deposits and debris and carbon would still get in the oil, turn it dirty, turn it black, and now you got some abrasives and bad stuff going around in the engine. Filters got better, engines got better, and the oil change interval started getting much longer. I started seeing 7,500 mile oil change intervals. This is even back in the 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And synthetics were not widespread back then. Now you see some car companies saying 10,000, some say 15.
That's a lot.
Some say change it when our system tells you to change it. And that can be 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 miles.
Yeah.
Here's what I'm starting to see and have been seeing. Those extended intervals start to put deposits in the engine in areas of the valve train.
Mm-hmm.
And cars now have what's called variable valve timing. And it uses the engine oil to change the camshaft's position for better efficiency, more power, better emissions, more powerful engine. But the oil is sludging these components up. And when the car gets later in its life, maybe the second owner now, maybe the third owner,
yeah,
long off of warranty, lo and behold, the answer is you didn't change your oil often enough. And then the customer says, but they told me I had to do it only every 7,500 or 10,000.
Yeah.
What I learned recently was a bit interesting. And apparently there is some pressure by the government to convince the car makers to extend those oil changes to reduce the amount of old oil or used oil that potentially can get in the environment.
Yeah.
And I totally get that. There's no question that that's bad. But I'm seeing a lot of engine-related issues, higher mileage cars, lack of service.
Okay, so if the government says, let's extend this for the sake of the environment and not have so much recycled oil out there, would it behoove the car manufacturers to then increase the tolerances that would make this a wise thing to do? Otherwise, the consumer is unfortunately the one who gets shafted.
Yes, and it's not really the tolerances or the engine makeup that is the issue. It's the oil staying in there too long, getting too contaminated. A lot of stop-and-go driving accelerates this issue. And now the oil is sludging things up. There's the only alternative or the only remedy is to go back to the intervals that change it much more often.
Right. Which then,
believe it or not, that 3,000 mile rule is not really that unheard of. Maybe 5,000 on full synthetic oil. But that's we get this question a lot. I bet we'll get some calls today about it.
Now, would it behoove everybody to, in fact, go to fully synthetic oil if they can afford it?
Well, it certainly is a good thing for any engine.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your oils are blends of synthetic to begin with. Some have more in it than others, and you're actually buying oil that says synthetic blend or full synthetic.
But full synthetic really isn't full synthetic anyway.
Still starts out with base crude oil. It's just more synthetic additives and chemicals go into it to make it, quote, synthetic.
I see.
So it's quite a subject.
All right. Well, let's get to the phones here at 1-800-348-2551. Lou in Altamont. Lou, you're first.
Howdy. I have a 2002 Ford F-150. The front end has rotted out on the frame to the point where the wheels are no longer really attached. How do I get the rest of my money back on it? Basically, it's a 59,000-mile vehicle. Engine transmission, it's been well maintained except for the fact that it continues to rust.
Sure. Lou, what year is the truck?
2002.
2002. There's a couple of ways where you can recoup, you know, the most you can out of that vehicle short of the scrapyard. Without giving out any names, if you contact some of the major salvage yards, they used to be called junkyards, but auto dismantlers and salvage companies that are selling used auto parts, they will buy vehicles from people and they will send a flatbed to pick it up.
Will you get a decent return on that?
You will get more than scrap value if this vehicle is something that has some used parts on it that they think they can resell.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me like an 02 pickup truck with low miles, you know, maybe more than just scrap value.
Okay.
So
are there some in this area?
Yes, there are.
I guess you just have to look them up because we really don't want to advertise.
Yeah, we can't really give you out the name of any one place, then I'll be in trouble.
Okay. Lou, thanks a lot for the call. Here's one that came in on our website, WAMC.org. This is from Nina. I have a 2008 Honda Fit, and in January when it was so bloody cold, the key got stuck in the driver's side door, and worse than that, stuck in a slightly turned position, so it constantly activates the lock all door as part of the locking system. Oh, boy. The car does not have a remote or keyless entry fob. Now we either have to leave the window rolled down enough to hold the unlock button down long enough to open the door or enter through the passenger side with a spare key. The door always returns to a locked position within a few seconds. So far, we haven't gotten locked out with the engine running. Quotes to fix it have been $450 and up. We're told that the mechanism is broken, not just frozen. The other option offered is to disable the locking system altogether so the car would never be lockable. Any suggestions, Gordon, or other options we could pursue? That's from Nina.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't say that. Does it indicate, Ray, that the key is still in the door?
Let me read it again here. I think it is. The key got stuck in the driver's side door, stuck in a slightly turned position, so it constantly activates the lock all doors.
Okay. This would be my suggestion, and maybe it's already been attempted. But let's say the key is not physically in the door, but it seems that the lock cylinder is partially engaged. Get some, like a WD-40 or some type of a penetrating oil that displaces water, and that's what this WD-40 is all about. And poke the red straw right in the keyhole. Push the little flap open and really spray a bunch in there a bunch of times. Do it one day, leave it alone, come back a couple hours later, or do it the following day. And then get the key in that lock and work it and see if that thing can be freed, because it's probably got corrosion in there.
But you never know, but Nina says she's been told that the mechanism is broken. Is that possible?
Yeah, it certainly could be. And then if that is the case, the door has to come apart to gain access to that lock cylinder to fix it.
Okay.
So that is true.
All right. And if you were industrious, you could probably take the door apart yourself, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you were handy enough to where you could get the door panel off and you could do a little exploratory yourself.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of different things inside doors nowadays.
Yes.
Probably not a Honda Fit, but a lot of cars have airbags now in those door panels. So you got some potentially touchy items in there. So you want to be careful.
That's right. I'm used to old cars.
Yeah.
And don't have to worry about that. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Rod in East Nassau. Rod, you're on.
Hi. I have a a Sonata, and it has a 10,000-mile warranty, and my engine fails. And so I thought, the warranty will cover it. Well, it turned out that the engine failed because of pests, rodents, and that was not covered by the warranty, and it cost me over $1,000 to have it fixed. So is there any hard and fast rule about how to prevent these? I think it's chipmunks.
We've talked about this before with a lot of callers.
Yes, this is also a popular subject. Rod, let me ask you this. Do you know what happened? Did they pack stuff in the intake tract? You know, did they get past the air cleaner, and did the engine suck in a bunch of debris?
I don't know. I don't know what parts they allowed. You know, I was questioning them. I wasn't so sure that they were being on the up and up with me, that they just made this up. So they gave me all kinds of stuff with leaves on it, debris on it. So I don't know what it was. I think there was a brake pad of some sort.
But this affected the engine?
There were these filters also.
Okay.
But I eventually just threw them away. So
yeah.
I don't know exactly what they were, but they...
Yeah, we do see this a lot. As a matter of fact, early this winter, I was servicing a customer's car. I had the hood open, and I was getting ready to put oil back in it, and a mouse ran across the top of the engine.
Wow.
Right in front of me. And one of the guys in the shop said, leave him there and get the car outside. We don't want the mouse inside here today.
Oh, that's a great point.
So, but in any case, this is what I've suggested. If you are in a garage with the car...
I don't have a garage.
Okay. Well, those electronic rodent, whatever you call it.
Repellers, yeah.
They emit apparently a really high-pitched sound that bothers rodents. I don't have any scientific proof that they work, but I have some cars stored in different places. One of them's in my mother's garage, and it got heavily infested with mice one winter. And we put these things all over the place. Maybe I'm just lucky. Haven't had any more mouse problems since.
You know, the science is not strong on that, but I've had success with those as well. Let's take a break here. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. We'll be back to your calls and your emails and whatnot coming up.
Support comes from the Henyon Bakery, Amherst. Since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Hubbard Hall Center for the Arts and Education, Cambridge, New York, presenting Molière's comedy Tartuffe, weekends through Sunday, hubbardhall.org. And Anise & Associates, a woman-owned business providing integrated technology, managed services, and cloud-based services to New York State since 1970. ANNESE.com/Albany.
Vox Pop on WAMC. We talk automotive maintenance and repair with our friend Gordon Fricke and you. The number to call, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Russ in Waterford. Russ.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My daughter has a 2002 BMW 325i, and she just bought it. She had some problems with it, so I took it into a mechanic, and they changed two of the coil packs. But they also said that there was a code that's suggesting perhaps that the catalytic converters might be bad, and they're going to put the coil packs in to see if they can get these things to heat up, which I don't know what that means. And secondly, apparently there's four converters on this, and if they're bad, they have to be replaced. My question is, are the coil packs somehow related to the heat in the catalytic converters, A? And B, can you eliminate the one that's a problem and replace that one, or do you have to replace them all?
Yeah, that's catalytic converters are quite a topic nowadays, primarily because of the state inspection program now has the car's computer monitoring all kinds of emission-related items, and the catalytic converter is a very important one because it does the cleanup of the exhaust gases. To go back to the symptoms, if the vehicle has a misfire by, let's say, these bad ignition coils, that particular cylinder is going to pour a bunch of raw gasoline into the catalytic converter or converters, depending on how that's split up. And it can damage them. It can clog them. Getting the car back running on all cylinders and then driving it is certainly the thing to do before you have to change those catalytic converters. There are some additives that are available that can be poured in the gas tank, and the vehicle can be driven with it in there. And they're certainly worth a try because if it's a deposit situation, rather than the converter is not cleaning the air anymore, or if it has a failure, the additive will clean those deposits up. So I think I would seek that out and try it before you just go do that, because it's going to be very expensive, as I'm sure you've learned.
No, it's over $2,500.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know why, if there's four of them, why I have to replace all four of them. I guess that, you know, there's no way of testing them individually. Do you have a name for the additive? Because what I had done was, when I first drove the car, because my daughter was trying to explain it to me, which was useless, I had thought maybe she just bought the car. I thought maybe it was an injector issue, so I put some seafoam engine cleaner in there. I've had luck with that before.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you have a recommendation for this additive? Yeah.
This stuff in particular cleans catalytic converters. So it's got it's got cat in the title.
Okay.
So if you go to a big, good parts store, they'll have this stuff.
Okay, you can give the name.
Yeah, it's called Cataclean.
Cataclean.
Okay. Cataclean.
Napa or Advance will have them.
Most of the big stores carry this stuff.
Thanks, Russ. We appreciate the call. Here's one that came in via email, Gordon. This is from Ashley. I have a Nissan Versa 2008. When I turn on the wipers, they will work for a bit, but when they... but then they just shut off mid-windshield for about 30 seconds and then kick in again. Once they do, the wipers do not reset back to the bottom of the windshield. They stick straight up and freeze over and over again. What could be wrong?
It's possible that the wiper motor is starting to get tired or developing problems, and it may be able to run a while, then it gets too hot and it shuts down, and it may be stopping midstream, cools off, the motor starts to run again. That's my guess without, you know, going any deeper, but it's very possible that it is an issue with the wiper motor itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be checked out more thoroughly because there are electronic controls that are operating those wipers, you know, part of the intermittent wipers.
So there's really nothing that Ashley could do on her own to figure this out?
I don't think so. I would just say that see if it has something to do with how long they've been running, and if it's pretty consistent based on the outside temperature, then maybe the motor is getting too warm.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go to Jack in Albany. Jack, you're on.
How you doing this afternoon, gentlemen?
Good.
I was calling because I have a 2004 Chevy Impala with the Metzis Center is reading service traction system. I want to know what's going on with that.
Yeah, your car, as do a lot of cars today, they have what's called traction control, and that prevents the tires from spinning or slipping on slippery roads when you accelerate. And it's
okay.
It's integrated into the anti-lock braking system, the ABS. It uses the same wheel speed sensors. So you may also have a warning that says ABS. Do you have an ABS light on as well?
Yes, ABS and traction off.
Yeah, they're both together. They use the same sensors. My guess is you may have a failing or failed sensor on one of the wheels, a wheel speed sensor. They're out in the environment, and they're being exposed to salt and junk and snow and dirt on the roads. You can't diagnose this yourself. It's got to be scanned and diagnosed, but usually it ends up being a wheel speed sensor.
You know, Jack, I have this problem from time to time in my car, and I have the same thing. I have a 99 GM car, and it only happens very briefly when it's very wet out. Maybe I go through a puddle. I just assume a sensor has gotten wet, and once it dries out, the lights go away.
Yeah, sensor or connector somewhere getting moisture. Very possible.
But that's not a deal breaker on an inspection, though, is
it? No, it doesn't affect it. It will pass with those lights on.
All right, Jack, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. Over to Beth in Schenectady. Beth, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi. I have a little Mini Cooper convertible that I bought last May, and I'm driving it about 5,000 miles a year, and I store it for about 5 months during the winter. They told me that my oil change needed to be done every 10,000 miles, which means it wouldn't have gotten done for 2 years, and I didn't really think that was a good idea, so I did have them do an oil change before I put it in storage in May or in November. But does the oil change depend on the amount of time that goes by as well as how many miles?
Great question.
Gone?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it does. What year is your Mini Cooper?
2014.
14. Okay. Yeah. You have variable valve timing that Ray and I spoke about earlier in the program, where Mini Coopers prior to, I believe, 07, maybe up to 05 or 06, did not have this. So, yes, you should change the oil once a year in that car. And if you were putting regular mileage on it, I would not go 10,000 miles between oil changes in any case. Okay. I would still do it at 5,000 miles.
Right.
So that's what I would do. I think you're right on track.
Do you have any tips for storing a car for 5 months? What might be important to keep it in good
shape?
We've
done this one before, too. Yeah.
It's extremely good idea to put a gasoline stabilizer in the gas the last day you drive it.
Okay.
And it would be nice. It depends on where it's stored, if it's in a garage. But tire pressures should be at their high spec, if there's a tolerance there.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of things you can do if you store a car for a long period of time. Do you find that after five months you're storing it?
Yes.
Does the car start?
Well, I have a battery keeper.
Yeah, that's my next suggestion.
Okay.
is keep a battery tender on it, and that will keep the battery alive. All the computer memories, all of your computers will stay remembering what they should be. You know, all your engine management controls. So, yeah, I think for that period of time, is it in a garage?
It's in my garage.
Yeah, I think that's probably enough.
Okay. Thanks, Beth.
Can I have one more quick question?
Sure, go ahead.
My neighbor told me that I should use gasoline that does not have ethanol in it, that it's the best way to keep your engine from getting gunked up. Do you agree it's...
Well, actually, there's a lot of talk about ethanol in gas, but one of the things ethanol is, being alcohol, it's a cleaner, so it's not going to gunk anything up. It's actually going to help clean things while it runs, and it's in all gasolines now. I mean, you can buy some ethanol-free gas if you really seek out some stations, but a 14 car is totally designed for it, so
okay.
I don't think that's an issue with your car at all.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Beth. The number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. Ray Graff here. Let's go to Fred in Greenwich, New York. Fred.
Hello. Calling from the big city. Gordon, I know we've talked in the past from Carmody, but I'm just calling in regards to the oil change interval question that was brought up earlier.
Oh, good point.
Most of the owner's manuals will tell you that for normal driving conditions, you can go up to the maximum. And they'll also have a secondary interval for your severe use. And if you look at your severe use, that's what most of us are doing.
In the Northeast, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We've
getting in, we're driving a mile, we're shutting her down, we're maybe going 5 miles to work, leaving it sit all day. We're driving on roads that are beautiful around here.
Yeah, and again, this is something we've talked a lot about. It's driving, driving harshly,
we do a lot of that here. They shouldn't call it severe because it makes people think, oh, I'm not severe on my car. We are in severe climate as far as car maintenance goes. And Fred, I'm glad you're calling with that because I know you see your share of cam shaft phaser and variable cam timing issues if you're in the Florida environment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, 5,000-mile interval is, that's cheap insurance as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely.
Especially when you consider how much it can be to fix a camshaft timing issue, which most of the time I find that it's because that the engine is just, it's gunked up.
Yep.
It's terrible.
Not enough oil maintenance, that's for sure.
Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Here's one that came in via email, Gordon. This is from Mark. I have a car that is relatively new. Every couple of weeks, my tire pressure light comes on. When it does, I run to the service station to add air to my tires, which fixes the problem. My buddy, who has an older car, never has this happen. His car is over 15 years old, and he never seems to be concerned about his tire pressure. Why is it that the older cars never seem to have this repeated issue with a tire pressure light? Well, you don't have a tire pressure light.
Yeah, right? That's part A, Ray. Part B is, if you were to look at two exact same cars parked next to each other in a parking lot,
yeah,
one has 34 pounds of air in the tires, the other has 31.
Mm-hmm.
You may not be able to ever tell the difference by the way the car is sitting. So a lot of people will just look at the tires and say they look fine.
It's fine.
But they're actually to the point where they need to be topped up with air to get back to the spec.
Yep.
And that's what these tire pressure monitoring systems are all about. There's a parameter. And they will illuminate the light when it reaches a threshold, and that indicates it's time to put air back in them.
Okay, let's go over to Annie in Del Mar. Annie, you're on.
Hi. Going back to the synthetic oil, having driven a 2008 Nissan Rogue, and it's got all these years, and it's got 60,000 miles on it, I've always done the 7,500, what you were talking about, every 7,500 miles. What happens if you just decide to switch over to doing regular oil changes, as you stated, between 3,000 and 5,000 miles?
So are you currently using synthetic oil?
Right.
Yeah.
I've never done anything different since I got it. Like your example, the dealer says, do this, and I did it.
Yeah.
And so every 7,500 miles, it's got actually 62,000 on it.
We service a lot of cars that call for synthetic to begin with, and a lot of these cars are turbocharged. And a turbocharger adds more stress and more heat, and it's tougher on the oil. So I recommend to anybody with those type of cars to do it every 5,000 miles with full synthetic.
Mm.
So if you plan on keeping your car a long time,
till it dies. But
yeah.
I don't. What do you mean by supercharged? I didn't think it was a supercharged car.
Yeah, no. I don't think your car has. In fact, I know your car does not have a turbocharger on it. The turbocharger just adds more heat and stress, so those need more frequent oil changes. I think what I would do if I were you is continue with the synthetic, and just drop it down to 5,000 miles.
Hmm. Okay. All right. So you don't recommend just switch over to
keep using the synthetic.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Annie. Over to Monty in Kingston. Monty, you're up.
Yeah, I've got a 1984 F-250 diesel, three-quarter ton, and now she's starting to rot out on the rocker panels and part of the little door. I was wondering, I went to body shops, and they don't even want to touch it. And I was wondering if there's anything I could do to keep those cancer things away from, to help it along. And the truck is in good shape. It's just I only got 146,000 miles on it.
Yeah.
But it's a 30-year-old. It's like me. I'm an old salt, so this thing is old salt too.
Yeah. Rust repair is fruitless because unless you spend extreme amounts of money with all new panels, it comes back. So if you try to cut out and put in patches or fiberglass those areas, it always comes back. And it's unfortunate that it'll just destroy a vehicle in the Northeast where we're using all these road salts. There are some guys in Vermont that do oil coating. They spray the underside of the vehicle, the frame. They go over the gas tank and the lines and inside the doors and rocker panels with oil, and it is supposedly non-toxic. It's not petroleum. It's fish oil or
Tried this? We've talked about this before.
Yeah, I know people that have had vehicles sprayed by these guys, and it will it will hold the rust back or preserve the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of your vehicle, it sounds like you may be pretty advanced, and it may not be anything that's going to do much for you at this point.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I feel sorry for the guys who own newer trucks, like 2002, like the guy was getting rust. You know, I was fortunate that they used good metals back in those days.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's an awful thing. That's the demise of most of your vehicles in salt states or salt climates.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much, gentlemen. I'll try to contact somebody up in Vermont, see what they have to say.
Thanks, Monty. We appreciate it. Number to call here is 1-800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest. As always, a popular program. We'll go through as many calls and emails and such as we can right after this.
Comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock and Rhinebeck, with a full calendar of events and workshops on Facebook and at sunflowernatural.com. And Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce, offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. UpstateDivorceMediation.com.
Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Whew, it's been a busy show, Gordon. And here's one that came in on our website. Says, this is from Paul. And he starts it wisely with a compliment. Says, great show. That
nice.
Gets our attention.
Yes, it does.
And then he goes on. I have a Nissan Sentra that keeps displaying the engine needs servicing light. When I put the computer on it, it tells me that it's the evap sensor. Aha! And that's, in New York at least, that is an inspection killer.
Yes.
I've changed this sensor twice so far. It seems okay for about 5,000 miles. The light came on again, and I put the computer on it. It says, small evap leak. I can keep changing sensors, but I'm sure there's a better way. Thanks for any info you can provide. That's from Paul.
Yeah. There are different sensors and solenoid valves in that evap system. And the evap system is there to keep your gas tank vapors contained, so they're not seeping out into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then the engine, being commanded by the computer, sucks these fumes in and burns them up and goes out the tailpipe. But if there's any leak in the system, it'll turn on the warning light that he's getting for a small evap leak. And unfortunately, that's one of the hardest to nail down. It can be anywhere from the gas cap to the engine, anything in between. All hoses, all connections, all fittings, the filler neck. It's a tough one to diagnose. You need what's called a smoke machine, and that introduces smoke to this sealed evap system, and then you scour the system and look for the escaping smoke.
Yeah.
And there you'll find your leak.
I think I saw a smoke machine at a Led Zeppelin concert once.
It might have been a different type.
I see. All right, here's one that came in via email. This is doesn't say from who. Oh, it's from Brian. I have a 2001 Chevy Silverado 2500 HD that does not always start. I've had the starter replaced, and that seemed to have worked for a month or so. But every now and then, when I turn the ignition key, there is nothing. Dead silence. I keep trying to start it. Eventually, it'll start up as normal. Any ideas what's going on?
Yeah, I would be checking, and this sounds very simple, but the battery connections. Chevrolet or General Motors uses a side mount, depending on what year his truck is. Does it say on there?
Let's go back to it here.
That's okay.
I got it. It's a 2001 Chevy Silverado 2500 HD.
Yeah, that's got what's called a side terminal battery where bolts go into it.
Mm-hmm.
And GM's had issues with those for years, that if those connections aren't perfectly clean and nice and tight, you'll get that condition. So start at the battery, follow those big giant wires to wherever they go, and make sure every connection where they terminate is clean, tight, and free of corrosion. One of them's going to go to the starter. The other one's going to go to the frame and or engine and body, and they all need to be perfectly clean.
And that's the ground?
Clean. And that's the ground.
Okay, so for those of us who want to do this at home safely, a wire brush, right, or a toothbrush?
Yeah, wire brush if there's corrosion on those connectors.
And vinegar, or what will get rid of the corrosion? What's a simple way to do that?
Vinegar does do it because it's a base. You can buy a product, an auto parts store that sprays on there. But baking soda was always a popular one.
Okay.
Baking soda with a little bit of water.
But not vinegar and baking soda because that's an explosive.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. No, vinegar is an acid. So, yeah, no, you got to use baking soda.
Okay.
Yeah,
So baking soda and a little water, just a little bit of water?
And that will make this bubbly foam. And then if he stumbles onto that bad connection, he's good. If it continues to do it, then there's issues of potentially being an ignition switch, neutral safety switch. Then it gets more technical.
Could be a bad starter, too, right? Even though it's a new one.
Yes. Never always be suspicious of the part you just replaced because
it's a rebuilt
you never
starter.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Scott in Pittsfield. Scott.
Yeah. Hi.
You're on.
I have a 2012 Honda Civic Si. It has about 79,000 miles on it. Around 40,000 miles, the clutch started to make this whining and humming sound when I would accelerate from a stop. And it only makes the sound as the clutch is engaging. It doesn't seem to affect the acceleration, and once the clutch is engaged and I shift gears, it doesn't make the sound anymore. So my question is, you know, what could cause that? And since it doesn't really affect the acceleration or driving, do I need to do anything about it?
All right, Scott, do you hear the noise when you're not in motion? In other words, if you just press down on the clutch pedal and maybe speed up the engine and then release it not in gear, can you reproduce that sound, or do you have
no.
to be in motion?
You have to be in motion, and it's only when you're engaging the clutch. Once it's engaged and you're in gear, you don't hear it.
Okay, so it's in the transition from the car's not moving to when you're letting up the
right.
clutch and getting the car going.
Exactly.
Well, what you could be hearing, are there a lot of miles on the car? Maybe you said earlier.
Yeah, 80,000 miles.
No, that's not bad.
Yeah.
You could be hearing the sound of the clutch disc engaging with the pressure plate and flywheel.
Okay.
And it's possible that it's reaching its wear limit, and mm-hmm. the little rivets on the clutch disc are starting to make contact with the two metal pieces. And there's
okay.
no way to really go in there and get a view of that on a car. Trucks, you can look and see what the clutches look like and even measure them. But,
okay.
So I think maybe it would be worth getting a mechanic's ear on that.
Mm.
Okay.
And just get somebody's opinion as to if you're good to go or if you got trouble coming, you know?
All right, Scott, thanks a lot. Let's go over to Ryan in Middletown. Ryan.
Hey, how you guys doing? I have an 05 Crown Vic that's giving me some intake sensors. Oxygen sensors are going off. And during idling, it gets shaky, goes smooth, and gets shaky again. But when I try to accelerate, it definitely doesn't give me any power. And a few days ago, it went off, and it just came back on. I believe I got water in it, but I'm not 100% sure.
Sure. When you say oxygen sensors, are you getting a check engine light, and is somebody scanning your system for codes?
Yep. It would be the heated oxygen sensor, bank 2, sensor 1, and it says high voltage, which they explained to me means there could be water contact.
And it's only one sensor. You're not getting simultaneous oxygen sensor failures. Or codes, I should say.
No, only one.
Only
code
on the one
up,
side.
But okay. It was a repeated code.
Yeah, you potentially could have a failing sensor. When people say I've got a code for two sensors, bank 1 sensor 1, bank 2 sensor 1, and they're both giving you the same reading as if it were the voltage was too low, for example, it's generally not the sensor. It's another problem, you know, the vacuum leak on the engine or something else is going wrong. What you can do is put some gas additives in it and get some ethanol treatment in the gas just to make sure there's not too much. You may have gotten some water or junk over the winter. But otherwise, to diagnose, that's going to, it needs to be hooked up, and somebody's got to read the sensors and try to tell what's going on with it.
Okay. Yeah, well, this all happened right after a car wash. So, like immediately after the car wash. Oh yeah,
no,
right after the car wash.
Maybe is the car rusty? Is it, how old is the car?
It's an 05 Crown Vic, an old
police
county
car?
Trooper's car.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, yep. get some gasoline treatment in there that will take care of water and ethanol issues, and just and give it a good dose of that, and just see if that gives you any results.
How long do you need to wait after you put that in?
If you've got a water issue, and the additive can handle it, it'll clear up fairly quickly.
Okay.
You know, 5-10 minutes of driving.
All right.
Try it.
Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. This is one that came in via email. With gas prices going up, I'm getting concerned about the best gas mileage. I keep hearing about some gas stations using a winter blend, and we've talked about this. What is this winter blend gas? Is it really all that different from summer blend? If so, which blend gives the better gas mileage?
Yeah. All refineries that send gasoline to cold states winterize their fuel.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're making it more volatile, making it light up easier.
Yeah.
Because the colder it is, the more resistant the gas is to lighting and burning. So they lighten it up for the winter. Otherwise, you'd have millions of cars that may not start or give terrible starting problems. That fuel is less efficient, so cars generally get poorer gas mileage in the winter months.
Okay, so it'll improve. When does the summer blend kick in?
They're going to start sending non-winter fuel, I would think, pretty soon if it isn't being delivered already.
Okay.
So you'll find that as you get into the spring, late spring, early summer, you may find that your gas mileage has improved.
Oh, good. All right, let's go to Kathy in the Berkshires in Hinsdale, I believe. Kathy, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm enjoying the show very much.
Thank you.
I have a question for Mr. Fricke, which is probably the most untechnical question he's had in a long time.
I like it.
I have a 2011 GMC Sierra, and I have a 20-minute commute to my job every morning and then again at the end of the day. I live at a very high elevation, and this road that I take has just turned to frost heave central. It's unbelievable. So my question is, would it behoove me to be driving in four-wheel drive as I start my descent to work and then pop it back into two-wheel at the foot of the hill?
So are you concerned with traction issues?
I'm more concerned with wear and tear on the vehicle, to be honest with you.
Due to the horrible bumps.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
The frost, I mean,
yeah.
There's a couple places where it's like, we're talking, it's almost a 3-foot
yikes.
Chasm.
Yeah.
It's really bad. It's a shortcut. Everybody tells me I'm nuts to keep doing it this time of year, but
yeah.
I've been told that before. So
I don't think the four-wheel drive is going to make it any easier on the vehicle.
Okay, that was my question.
I don't think it's going to affect it one way or the other.
All right.
The only thing that you can do, which I'm sure you're doing, is
yes,
go very slowly
yes.
until the roads get better.
Yes, okay. I just wondered.
I have a flatbed truck, a car, you know, a rollback for hauling cars.
Yeah.
And it's an international. It is so stiff and rides
yeah.
pretty poorly that yeah. I'm on roads now that people are behind me with their fists out the window because
yeah,
I can't, I have to go so slow.
Well, that was me.
That,
yeah.
I get that every morning, but like I said, I was more concerned about the wear and tear on my vehicle because I do plan on keeping it for a few more years.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. You've answered my question.
Kathy, thank you very much. I guess you could always avoid that shortcut for a while.
Well, maybe put a few extra miles on it and take an easier road.
All right, let's go to Jerry in Albany. Jerry, you're on.
Yes, didn't catch the whole show, and I know you were talking a lot about oil changes and so forth and frequency.
Yeah.
I had something as a variation on that, in that I was looking at a recent current model year cars. I'll mention brand, Subaru.
All right.
And what I'm finding out is online is that some of those models occasionally have had oil consumption problems, perhaps relating to the use of the synthetic fuels blowing by and so forth. And what they're telling me at a dealership is that they consider any consumption, oil consumption of less than, I'm sorry, as long as I don't burn more than 1 gallon of oil, one quart of oil every 1,300 miles, they will consider that normal wear and tear on the car.
Yeah.
So if I drive 1,300 miles and have to have an oil change, not change, but a quart of oil,
top
they say that's normal.
Yeah.
If they say it's 1,000, I got to top it off. I just wonder, should something like that be considered normal?
Yeah, yeah, it is now, and it used to be years ago. There was a midpoint where cars really consumed very little oil, but all engines consume oil. But sometimes it's so little that you can't measure it, or by the time you go get it changed, nobody's checked it. You're down 2 quarts, 3 quarts, 1 quart, and nobody knows the difference. What's happened of late is that the engineers have reduced the tension on the piston rings. And what that does is it makes the engine turn easier, and that reduces friction, which reduces energy consumption, gives you a little bit better fuel economy.
Yeah.
The downside to that is those piston rings are also keeping the oil out of the combustion chamber. Well, now that there's less tension on those piston rings, a little bit of oil is sneaking by that maybe didn't do that 20 years ago or 10 years ago. So oil consumption is now prevalent again. And most car makers are saying, and a lot of them are on a 1 quart to 1,000 miles is considered normal.
Mm.
So anyway, to answer your question, Jerry, that is the way it is now and is nothing to worry about. It's not an engine issue. And people need to get in the habit of having their oil checked once in a while like they used to in the 50s, 60s, 70s.
Well, it's fine if you're in Jersey where they're all full service, but you find a go find a full service gas station around here.
There aren't any.
Yeah, you have to do it yourself.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes. No, that's the issue. Yeah.
All right.
I'm glad you told me, because I was almost tempted to run away from the brand, and now you're telling me it's simply what.
No, some burn more than others, but they all use some.
Okay.
Real quick question, if I could.
All right.
How does that tire pressure sensor that you mentioned earlier work?
I had
mine go the other day, and I couldn't understand how it worked.
Yeah, very, very briefly, on the other end of your valve stem inside the wheel is a pressure sensor with a battery and a radio transmitter, and it sends a signal to the computer in the car as to the tire's temperature and pressure. And that's how it works.
Okay. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Let's try to get another couple of calls in here. Charlie in Pittsfield. Charlie.
Yeah. Am I on?
Yep, very quickly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, very quickly. Very quick about oil. What's the deal with changing back and forth between conventional and synthetic and older cars? I get different opinions.
Okay.
How old is the car you're talking about, Charlie?
I've got cars, you know, from mid-90s.
Yeah. Anything of that vintage, you can use synthetic oil in no problem.
It won't start leaking.
No. There is talk about putting it in classics and antiques because you have higher tolerances, poorer seals, and
uh-huh.
a lot of the synthetics don't have the zinc and some of the other additives that they had way back in those days for the what they call tappets or cam followers.
Uh-huh.
But on a car 90s vintage and up, you can use synthetic or synthetic blends.
Okay, so I can put synthetic or synthetic blend into a 95 Honda Civic.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, one about oil. I have a 99 Buick Regal, and for some reason in both the owner's manual and stamped right on the oil filler there, it says to only use 1030. What's the story with that?
Yeah, they've changed the viscosities around, and it has to do with, a lot of it has to do with how easy the engine spins, and the newer cars using much, much lighter oil to get better efficiency. So on your car, you know, stick with what they tell you on the cap.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Charlie. Very quickly here, Gordon. This is via email, and this is from Kara. Had new all-season tires installed on a 2015 Honda Civic before taking delivery in February. After only 1 week, on a night of frigid weather, tire pressure warning came on. Have had pressure checked at the tire store. Everything looks good. But warning keeps coming on whenever she starts the car. So what do you think? Ignore it?
If the tire pressures are all truly correct and the pressure light is on and she didn't indicate whether the light was flashing or not.
It doesn't say.
Could be an issue with one of the sensors. It may have by accident gotten broken during the tire change. That's a possibility.
Okay, so it really was just coincidental to the frigid weather, you think?
Well, didn't she say she just had tires put on it?
Yes. Yeah. And then it was after 1 week, and it was a frigid night, it came on.
I would have the sensors tested to see if one of them's failed.
Well, we are done, my friend. Gordon Fricke, that was a busy hour.
Boy, it didn't stop, did it?
No, it did not. Support comes from East Heaven Hot Tubs and Paradise Spa. Northampton, Massachusetts, offering private hot tub room rentals with indoor or outdoor rooftop tubs, massage for couples and individuals, eastheaven.com. And Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Over 300 flavors of handcrafted dairy and dairy-free ice creams, cakes, hot fudge, and more, harolds.com. Thanks to Gordon Fricke of Barber and Fricke in Hoosick Falls. Thanks to Zach Malloy. And your phones were answered by Mary Vetter. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein. Marshall has the day off today, but she still wrote the script. She left it for me, which is very nice. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag, but it's pie. We're doing a pie show tomorrow. Tune in.